started what we call the Jewish Values Network. We changed the name because it's not just Jewish values, it's universal values. And the idea behind the nonprofit is to take that which is universal, that can be shared with the rest of the world, and share it. And so I was recently, I've been a volunteer for the organization for years, but I was recently hired to be the national director of Turn Friday Night into Family Night. And we'll talk about that this evening, but essentially it's to take the idea of the Sabbath and Shabbat, and to make it available for everyone else, strip it of its all the religious things, leave that which is important to the hearing of the family, and tell the world about it. So that's part of what I do. But why don't you guys have a seat?
Yeah. Okay.
And Reverend to my right is Reverend Charles Kimball Jr. Reverend, he is a native Philadelphia, felt called to the ministry and became an ordained minister in 1969. And served churches as far away as California to New York, here in New Jersey. Healthcare chaplaincy, social work, and working with are some of the other specialties that he's done. He's graduated from Princeton Theological Seminary, quite my wife. And he's not only the minister of this church, but also Bethany Presbyterian Church, also community. And also we have with us Felicia Stoller. All these are, I'm just getting to know the Reverend, but already a very good friend. These other folks are good friends as well. So Dr. Felicia Stoller, registered dietitian, exercise physiologist, consultant with disease prevention, wellness, and healthful living. You may recognize her. She was a host on TLC, Honey, We're Killing the Kids, which was an incredible show. And even more recently, actually to come within a couple of weeks, is Felicia's first book, Living Skinny in Fat Genes. And so, genes spelled with a G. Yes, right? The healthy way to lose weight and feel great. It's going to be a bestseller, I'm sure. And Rabbi Shmuley Botea needs no introduction in some circles, but the rabbi founded this World of Values Network. He also had a show on TLC, and I think that's how you met. Called Shalom.
Yeah, my show was better than Felicia's. and I look better on camera as well.
Shmuley's written 24 books, and so we have a number of them back there. The biggest blockbuster was a book called Kosher Sex, so that was an international bestseller. And there's been many others. 10 Conversations You Need to Have with Your Children is the next one that I'm going to read. I've been trying to read that for a while, but I'm going to do it. He's had numerous radio shows, including was on the Oprah Network, the Rabbi, and a number of others in this community just recently formed the Synagogue of the Palestinians. Between all of us, I think there are 17 children. Shmuley has 9, and then the rest of us have more reasonable numbers.
Well, I have 9 when you started the introduction.
So I think that's a good number for me to stop. I think, and for us to begin our conversation this evening. So we're going to talk for about a half hour or so, and then get into questions. A small group, we can really have this wonderful conversation all together. And we'll start off with, I think the first question would be. The
good idea to define spirituality. That's a very good idea.
Okay.
Felicia?
No. No problem. Not much pressure, right? Something I don't speak about often, but you know, spirituality is really that energy from within, and it's sort of your, I think on some level, it's your belief system, whatever that may be, something that really gets you up and going, and part of your values.
Reverend Gilmore.
Thank you. I think of spirituality as the part of reality that we cannot apprehend or see or any of, you know, our five regular senses, that there is a reality beyond what we can see, hear, taste, touch, smell, a reality of values, as we've been mentioning here, a reality where there is a higher power, the reality that says other people are of value, that the world is, that the earth itself is of value. So anything that's important but is not part of the material world per se, but of how we deal with each other and with the material world, I think that encompasses spirituality. That can include the divine, the higher power. For me, it does. For some people, it doesn't. But that's what I think spirituality is. It's what makes us human rather than just another creature.
Well, I'd like to answer the question in context of tonight's discussion about raising spiritual children. A materialistic child is a child who is self-centered, self-focused, and who, for whom objects brings happiness. You give him something and he's happy. A spiritual child is other-oriented. He's able to transcend the self. He finds greater joy in giving that rather than taking. And for me, spirituality is where there is a manifest connection between anything and God. So I know I'm in a spiritual place when I feel God's presence. I know I'm having a spiritual moment when I feel that I'm being raised above material reality and I'm experiencing God in my life. I know for a lot of people, particularly those who adhere to New Age spirituality, spirituality has very little connection with God. But I've discovered that you might think you're having a spiritual experience, but it's just another selfish experience. It's still about you. It's about your own enlightenment. It's about something that makes you feel good. That's not spirituality. Spirituality must encompass an altruistic dimension. Our problem with kids today is America's great problem, which is no civilization in human history has ever mastered success. Arnold Toynbee, the great Oxford scholar, wrote about all the world's great civilizations and what led to their deterioration. It was not some enemy invading them from without. And it was not famine, and it was not poverty. What mostly destroys nations is excess, too much. It's where you become corrupt. In ancient Rome, for example, every other day was a holiday. And even the days they worked for 4 hours every day because they had servants and slaves. They had conquered so many nations. Other people did the work for you. And the net result is, what do you do with all your extra time? Well, the ancient rabbis of the Talmud said, when you have nothing to do, you do what you ought not to do. Idleness breeds corruption. So our kids come home, and we don't give them enough chores around the house. They don't have enough responsibility. In middle-class families or wealthy families, they have maids that do the work for them. Even if they have chores, there's nothing very, very serious. We don't give them enough after-school activities that are about doing for others. They're usually after-school activities like ballet and the chess club and the golf lessons and God knows what else, which is all about them developing themselves. And the message they get is me, 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 me. And we just enforce that narcissism. And that is what has led to the growth of so many of these social networks. Yes, I love Facebook, and it's a phenomenal tool, or any of the others, Twitter, and I use them extensively. But we have to ask ourselves whether a culture where kids spend so much time telling everybody about what they ate for breakfast and what their favorite color is a healthy culture.
Really touched upon that in his comments. But in terms of living in a materialistic age, what does that mean to each of you? Start with you.
I think it really means that, as Shmuley said, we're more and more consumed with the things we consume. We're more and more concerned about what we have, who we know, what we drive, what our portfolio has in it, our property, our home, our second home, you know, et cetera, et cetera. With these accoutrements, these things, these trappings that make us feel, or are supposed to make us feel that we are successful. And it scares me to see the extent to which that is going on. It also scares me, because I think it does Shmuley and Grant, to see kids who are doing this all the time. They're focused in on their selves and their friends and their little networks. And I'm not sure that they're aware of what's going on around them sometimes. You know, you have to almost tell them, put down the Twitter, put down the Facebook, put down the personal device, because we're having dinner. Because, you know, we're at a movie, because we're in church or in synagogue, you know, it's like there's a real addiction that seems to be going on among many of our children and among some of their parents as well. You know, a lot of adults do the same kind of thing constantly. And I think the emphasis on what we have, who we know, what we own, what we drive, what we're wearing, is just, it has really gotten out of hand. Maybe I'm repeating what Oregon said, but I really see it, and it really scares me. So I have to speak on it from that level.
So I'll bridge actually over to something that I think that people relate to. If you want to make a comparison about the overconsumption of technology, you could look at the way we look at food in our culture, and that food in America is very cheap and inexpensive, and we overconsume food, which is why we have this problem called obesity in this country. So you just want to bridge it over. I mean, parents don't want to say no to their kids about eating. They don't want to say, no, you can't have another snack. No, you shouldn't eat that. No, you shouldn't drink that sugared soda. You shouldn't have that ice cream. Because we're, you know, working parents, we're busy. We don't want to take the time. We perceive that it's too difficult to take the time to cook a meal the way our parents did. So we're a quick impulse satisfied society, even with food, and as a result of that, we, you know, we are the largest nation in the country, and now we, you know, we're unfortunately, our bad habits are rubbing off around the globe.
Wow, I'm about to go and jump off a bridge. obviously, it's not as bleak as we're all painting it up here. What we're rather saying is that kids need values. Now, what are their values today? What are the values with which we are meant to inculcate within our kids? And are those values being taught by parents? So for me, value number one is curiosity. Kids are naturally curious. Are we enhancing our children's curiosity, or are we satisfying it with items that actually stifle curiosity? So for example, if your child asks you a lot of questions, and you give them trite answers because you have no time for them, they're going to stop asking. But the same thing is true in school. If they go to school and they're only taught to take a test, but they're not really taught to enjoy knowledge, when they come home, they're not going to read books. When they come home, they're going to watch tons of TV. And if we learn to pacify them with television, then again, their curiosity will be stifled. And what's the point if they get into Harvard even and make a lot of money if they don't have curiosity? They're going to have bad marriages. They're going to be married for two years. They're going to think, the guy's going to think he knows his wife completely because people don't have depth. And they'll stop talking. They'll go to movies on Saturday nights. They're one date night a week, which is what most American couples do. And once the communication ends, the marriage begins to die, and the child concludes that love isn't real. So money and success are not going to compensate for the loss of curiosity. The next very important value to instill within children, which again kids have naturally, is a sense of awe and wonder. You know, if a man looks at a woman, there's one of three responses. The first is, there's a woman, how do I enjoy her? That's the misogynist approach, which has led to a generation of male womanizers, especially at university campuses. Response number two is, there's a woman, how can I collaborate with her and build something? She becomes my partner. That's nice, but it's not very romantic. And it's amazing that in marriages today we use that strange term partner as if it's a business transaction. And the third thing is you can have a sense of an awe and wonder. Wow, there's this a woman and she's beautiful and impressive and I'd like to respect her and be in a relationship with her and learn from her. And children have a natural sense of awe and reverence. Everything surprises them. The smallest thing, they love that awe and reverence. And all we can do, and that doesn't have to be nurtured by parents. It already exists. All you have to do is make sure that you don't trample on it, that you don't use bad language in front of them so they learn that language is nothing special, that you don't speak badly about people so they learn that gossip is the way you really have relationships. So it's not, you know, we're speaking about kids being bad. Kids are not bad. I've never met a bad kid. Kids, and they're not good either. To say that kids are all naturally good, rather kids are innocent. They're neither good and they're not bad. And their actions will determine what they become in life. Whether they rise to a level of virtue or whether they indict themselves to their own selfish actions. And they're going to copy what we do. So the real focus is on what we're doing as parents. And I see a nation that doesn't really have proper values today. And one of the reasons is, this is what's so interesting about having this conversation in a church, I think the failure of religion in America is a large reason for the loss of values. All religion talks about in America are gays. Gay marriage day and night, abortion day and night. It's like, if I hear any of these two subjects discussed anymore, I'm like, I'm going to eat my yarmulke. I mean, I can't really listen to this anymore. The entire American family is disintegrating, and let's talk more about gay marriage. We have kids who are being neglected, let's talk about the unborn children. It begins to evade reality that we can't talk about anything else. So if religion doesn't actually focus on the loss of values and have more conversations like these, I don't see how it's going to get better. Because, you know, we always rely on our politicians to give us values. You know, we look at, oh, this politician, I can't vote for him because he cheated on his wife. Who says that politicians are supposed to be values teachers? Politicians are supposed to balance budgets. They're supposed to run a city effectively. Where do they come teaching us values? It's expecting it from the wrong quarter. It's supposed to come from religious inspiration, and that's where the breakdown is.
And I think a lot of that is that most people are, you know, the religion, at least Christianity, I think, in this country, mainstream Christianity, Protestant Christianity, has slowly become less and less the way people relate. Church is less and less important as we go from recent history to today. And maybe the same for people who are practicing other faiths, too. It's just that this is becoming more and more of a secular thing, so people don't see that religion has any value to them or to their children. When I was a young man, I heard people, because I grew up in the 60s, and I heard people say, oh, I'm not going to expose my kids to any religion. I don't want to brainwash them. I don't want to force them into a mold. When they're older, they can choose their own religion. Well, guess what? If they haven't been exposed to any religion, choose
right.
Religion because it will be irrelevant to them. So if you follow religion, if you have a faith-based viewpoint in life, fine. You know, expose your children to that. Bring them into that. Let them see what that's like. Let them function within it. They may rebel against it later. Kids rebel against stuff. That's part of how they develop themselves and find out who they are as against who you are. But if there's nothing for them to rebel against, then they won't have any interest in it really at all, and it won't help them form their values. So.
Okay, the next question, you know, when we focus on a lot of what's wrong, and I think that we can find agreement with a lot of that, let's talk about raising healthy children. What are some of the things that we can begin to model to do better jobs with this most important job that us parents have?
Well, the first thing is you can't expose them to trashy TV. If you let your kids watch Felicia's show, for example, I mean, they're just innocent kids, for goodness sake. Actually, my show used to follow your show. So if nobody watched your show, they didn't watch my show. Now, Felicia, I just think it's time that you stop corrupting American kids. I just, So how do we raise healthy children, Felicia?
Well, one thing I always say is that a parent for children a better lives than we have, right? And the most important thing we can do is give them the gift of health. And we've learned so much about health and disease over the years that there are so many ways to prevent diseases. I mean, example, I'm in the field of nutrition and exercise science, and those two sciences alone in the last three decades have really grown tremendously in that we've been able to correlate behaviors, and whether it be physical activity behaviors or food consumption or smoking or consumption of alcohol to disease. We didn't know a lot of this stuff 30 years ago. So I went to graduate school, I had my first child, and now being a mother, I feel like my children are my science experiment. I get to take everything that I learned in school, and I hopefully will give them the blessing of health from the inside out, because by the time I went to school, a lot of the damage was done. You know, by the time you're in your mid-20s, you know, most of the foundation for heart disease has already been set. So, yes, I could say I want my kids to live in a nice house, and I want them to have nice things that we're talking about, but I really want my children to have the gift of health. So I want them to be physically active. I want them to make better food choices. I want them to sleep. Like, I want them to do things to take care of their body so that they will hopefully live longer than I would.
So, like, all the junk food is out?
Yeah. You know, all things in moderation, you know, that's sort of my mantra, but, you know, that's so important to me. I've watched family members die earlier than they needed to of heart disease, and it was just so unnecessary, and it was so preventable, and so...
And this is a theological question. Why did God make all really unhealthy food taste amazing?
Didn't make it, we did.
And like all the healthy stuff, if I bit into this chair, it would taste better.
You know, if you go back to eating from the ground up, which is what, you know, most parts of the world people do, you know, it's grains, it's plant foods, you know, animals were not very easy to catch a long time ago without weapons. So we really relied on the land. I don't know if that stuff tasted that great.
So basically, you think we should all have like a trough pulled over our head and like eat barley and oats? No, I want to, you know, God, you know, he's got a lot of explaining to do.
Absolutely.
So more about raising children, about, you know, the healthy things.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with Felicia, because I don't know, I mean, I didn't always eat healthy, and I'm an incredible sexy specimen of manhood till today. Tall and lean. No, I think Felicia's right that it's so unfair that we addict our kids to this garbage, all these bad foods. But for me, I'm not a nutritionist, so I'm not going to focus exclusively on the food part, but rather on the values that underlie it, which is discipline. That kids can learn to control their passions, to control their urges. That just because you want to eat something that's not healthy for you, you don't do it. Just because you want to say something that's not going to be favorable to someone else doesn't mean you don't say it. You know, in the Jewish religion, the prohibitions on things like gossip are key. And this whole stupid celebrity-obsessed culture where you spend most of your life talking about other people is kind of sad, because it teaches a child that you're not important enough to focus on yourself. You rather need artificial royalty. You know, back in Europe, they used to talk about the kings and the queens and the princes. We don't have that in America, so we invent them in Hollywood, and we spend our lives talking about them. I don't really care much about them, to be perfectly honest. So we have to wean themselves off of that. I think I find it astonishing that in the United States, the entertainment industry has become front and center. Any one of you sitting here today would be hard-pressed to name one famous court jester from 500 years ago. You could name the serious people, the writers, the poets, but you couldn't name the guy who got on with like little bells jumping up and down. And yet they're the most famous people in our culture, actors and actresses. Like, I watch the Academy Awards every year, and I always say to myself, as my kids get all excited to watch the Academy Awards, like, what message does this send to the kids? The only award ceremony in America where everybody obsesses over it is not over who gave the most charity, who volunteered the most, which soldiers risked their lives so that other people could be free. I mean, one guy gets the first soldier since Vietnam gets a living Congressional Medal of Honor 3 weeks ago. I wonder if anyone in the room, myself included, can still say his name. We wouldn't know, even though he has an incredible story, immigrant to this country. But we probably know who the lighting design director is on any one of many shows. What that says to a child is that celebrity and notoriety and recognition is more important than character and virtue. So why develop those things? Popularity in school is more important than doing the right thing. Selling out and ratting on, speaking badly about kids in order to be part of the cool set is more important than befriending children who may be ignored and neglected. That's where the bullying thing comes from. Yeah.
I think that the word, say it in a different way, a value that we have to convey to our children is reverence. And I don't only mean reverence for God, the divine, for a higher power, but reverence for themselves, reverence for each other, reverence for life, so that you don't mistreat somebody because he looks different than you or she doesn't dress the way you do because they have an accent. You don't use these things to treat people in different ways. Instead, you have respect.
Right.
And you affirm affirm them and accept them for the way they are.
Right. Well, in inculcating values like that, reverence, which I really appreciate, Charles, there is no substitute for conversation. That's why I wrote the book, 10 Conversations You Need to Have with Your Kids. You can actually talk to your children about this. And I relate a lot of the conversations that I have with my kids. But take reverence, for example. If you speak to your kids about these things, like what I do almost every night, and I've been lax for the past few months, to be perfectly honest, since I've had a writing deadline, but I try to study with my kids 10 minutes, 15 minutes every night. The Bible, because in the Jewish religion, you read a section of the Bible every week and you complete it. Five books of Moses over a year's cycle. So every day, every week is split into seven, so you have a section a day. And we study it, and then we talk a little bit about it. And it allows me to have conversations that are not contrived. It's not like I say, okay, sit down, and I'm going to preach to you about reverence. It's rather that, like last week, we were reading about Joseph forgiving his brothers. And I started speaking to my kids about the need to not bear grudges, because you can become bitter. And these conversations are invaluable. And I think you get a lot of pride as a parent when you see your child beginning to lecture you in the same way. So for example, using reverence, Charles, we do Friday night Sabbath dinners every Friday night at our house. Felicia and her husband have been to us many, many times. John has been there many, many times. Sometimes there'll be a very important person, someone that I have to give special attention to because whatever, I feel I have to. It's quite amazing that my kids, like when that person will leave, my kids will say, you know, Tati, it's amazing. This other guy sat right across from you the whole night and tried to ask you questions, and you barely listened to him. Mm. And you barely gave them any attention because they weren't important enough in your eyes. And that shows that you don't have any real reverence for people, that you put them in some sort of hierarchy. And they're right. Now, I only use that as an example because I would never do that, of course. But some of the people on the stage might. But it's quite amazing when your children turn that around. Or when I talk to my kids about the addiction to Facebook or the texting. See, I think that also comes from an inner emptiness. I tell my teenage kids, the fact that you have to follow so many people's lives so obsessively shows that you're not as happy with your own life as you ought to be. I'm not speaking about arrogance where you become full of yourself, but I am talking about contentment where you believe you have a gift to contribute to the life of others, that you can be a blessing to others. But you're obsessively following this person and that person. I think it also leads to another negative quality. The other day I heard something very interesting. We had these girls over from a religious, an Orthodox Jewish university in Manhattan. They stayed with us for the Sabbath. And they were telling me that when one of their friends gets engaged, they're not happy for her. Their immediate reaction is one of jealousy. They'll like smile, but it's crocodile. Is there an expression, crocodile smile? Or? And they're not really happy for them because, again, when you obsessively follow someone else, it's usually because you're not as happy with yourself. But that also means that you can't be happy for other people when they have things to celebrate because you feel that their happiness detracts from your own.
That is the concept of limited good, which was very, very prevalent in biblical times, especially in early biblical times. That if Felicia gets something more than I get something less, there's only something
right.
to go around.
Right.
And that is not the reality of how the world is. There's plenty for everybody and a lot left over. But if her doing better diminishes me in some way, then there's something wrong with that. That's just not true. But we operate as it is.
Actually, it's a quote that I have heard You know, I, besides doing stuff within my field, I mentor a lot of students, and I know when I first got into my career, nobody wanted to mentor me, nobody wanted to help me, because if they helped me, it was taking away from them.
Right.
And I've always felt that if I can help somebody else, you know, through that notion of pay it forward, it's not because I want something back, but if I can help somebody so they can go out into the world and they can help people be healthier and be happy, then I've done my job, right? It's sort of like the old Packaging Organics, their commercial, if I help you friends, then they get a and they tell two friends and so on, then we can really have greater good in this world.
Well, this is why what Charles was saying about limited good or this deprivation mentality has to be actively combated by us talking to our kids. And of course, even speeches are never a substitute for real action. Modeling hospitality for our children, having a lot of people around, which isn't easy, but very important.
Yeah.
Let's hear from our friends on this other side. What questions do you have, comments that you'd like to share? Yes, sir. First of all, who are you?
Said earlier on, when Dr. King said about 40 years ago that you're becoming a thing-oriented society instead of a person-oriented society, you were fighting in Vietnam. And 40 years later, everybody wants to kill us. Is it a case of the chickens coming home to roost? Or you think it was that it could have been prevented, say, 40 years ago or 40 or 50 years ago, as opposed to trying to deal with it now?
You all
don't
look at me like I have an answer
for
this.
Well, we're the same age, so.
Okay, I see.
But you look older.
I look.
I am much older. Cynical and burned out, for sure.
I do believe that what goes around comes around, so that we are, if we become more and more thing oriented, then I do believe that that causes other nations, which are less, you know, well, economically, to resent us because, you know, oh, the Americans have everything, you know, and our deity, our God that we really worship a lot of times is not higher power, but it is something material. So I think, you know, that triggers a resentment in other cultures, and sometimes they do want to cut us down to size, you know, knock America off its high horse, so to speak. That's true.
Well, I mean, there's so many parts to your question. First and foremost, the United States is the most blessed country in the world. And a blessing means responsibility. And the question is, what are we doing with our blessings? Is it benefiting us? The United States is now the most depressed country in the world, statistically. One out of three American women is on an antidepressant. 75% of the world's antidepressants are consumed here in the United States. So the question is, why is that? And I think the principal reason is that money doesn't bring happiness. Purpose brings happiness. You have to feel purposeful. And studies show that people who are in purposeful professions have the highest rates of happiness. And yet we continue to choose professions that are the most lucrative as opposed to the most... like, I know with myself, when I'm doing something purposeful, here I am, all four of us in front of perhaps, what, 30 people? I'm sure it's not the biggest audience Reverend Gilmore has ever addressed. It's not the biggest audience. Well, in my synagogue, this would be triple our normal. Maybe Felicia, it's not the largest audience. And for me, it's not the largest audience. But I feel perfectly content being here because I feel we're discussing something very important that really is on my mind. So I think contentment breeds happiness. That's why I'm not planning to leave even when we finish. I think Charles is going to have a run from his money for me. You know, this coming Sunday, I think your Congress is going to have to vote between you and me. And my beard is longer. And that means, you know, that's a sign of wisdom, by the way. He's long beards.
Oh.
So, well, just to finish the thought. The rest of the world is going to look at us and they're going to say, wow, all this wealth, what are they doing with it? And all these blessings, what are they doing with it? Now, if we do great stuff with it, then they're going to respect us. If we just export the dumbest, most vapid culture in the history of the world, then they're going to say, wow, that's kind of a way, what a way to waste it. Not that they're much better. You know, Europe is as vapid. But I think, especially like when I visit continents like Africa, it's very interesting to see the people who have nothing looking at us with all this stuff. And I think they do sort of wonder, you know, what do you guys do with it? And we need to show benevolence. By the way, I am not anti-wealth, and I am not anti-material possessions. On the contrary, I hope that everyone in this room becomes wealthy, God willing. I hope everyone in this room has what you need and more. There's a famous blessing in the prophets that God will give us so much that we will be saying to him, die, enough. I just hope that you'll use it for something truly glorious and special. I'm a great believer in the Maimonidean adage of moderation. By all means, you know, make money. It's just, don't believe that the purpose of the money is to spend it all on yourself. Do good. It's the selfishness rather than the wealth. Money is neutral. It's like drugs. People say drugs are terrible. No, they're not. Drugs keep people alive every single day. I have high cholesterol. I take drugs to keep my cholesterol down. I could read Felicia's book and I'll be eating tree bark. Drugs keep people alive. Drugs are very important. It's just that the wrong drugs or the abuse of drugs is the problem. Same thing is true with money. You can't say money is the root of all evil. Money's wonderful. Without money, we can't clothe the naked. We can't feed the hungry. But the abuse of money is the problem. Indulging kids. So wealth is not the issue. I hope America will always be a wealthy country. Although I'm not sure it will. Because once you no longer have values and you don't work hard and you spend everything you have. This country, by the way, is basically bankrupt. The richest country in the world is bankrupt. If you saw the 60 Minutes thing yesterday, it was scary. Because we thought, first there was the bailout with all the banks. And it was very nice that we bailed out all of our Wall Street billionaires because, you know, those Hampton homes, they are necessities. It's hard to live without one. I know I want one, which is why I chose the wrong profession. But yesterday, 60 Minutes was all about how all the cities are now bankrupt. All the municipalities are bankrupt. All the states are bankrupt. They're gone. And now the federal government's got to bail them out. The federal government owes $13 trillion. The country's bankrupt. And that all comes from consumption. Mm-hmm. You know, in China, they have different values. Not that everything there is wonderful, because the Chinese government, I think, is, one might even say, evil in a lot of what they do. The way they're locking up the Nobel Peace Prize winner and treating him like a piece of garbage because all the guy wants a little bit of freedom. But their values when it comes to thrift and when it comes to savings, things that Benjamin Franklin talked about all the time and which were original American values, their values are, you know, if you go to Europe, and I lived in Europe for 11 years, you'll see every king built himself this incredible mansion. In the United States, we have the White House is, okay, it's fancy, but nothing compared to, these buildings were built at a time of real thrift. Americans were not extravagant. Now, whoever the president is, Obama, Bush, Clinton, they travel in motorcades that no emperor ever had. I mean, we overdo everything. Everything has to be so big in America. Like, size matters. When John, you know.
I'm going
there. It's quality rather than quantity. Well, look, what I meant to say is, I'm about 5 foot, okay? So good things come in small packages. And so do Napoleon complexes. Okay.
Another question. Has modern technology? I'm a salt on Broadway. Should I get my credit card number too?
Weird.
What's it called? How do I say this? Modern technology, has it led to the fact that we're getting so many things so much faster than we used to, has it led to more impatience? And if yes, has that led to bad relationships with people?
Well, let me say one thing, that in the 50s and 60s, there were all of these appliances that were created that were supposed to give women freedom. women's lives easier. The question is, has it, right? And then everything that we have now, I mean, and I'm just as guilty of this, my husband will tell you that, you know, for me, when I finally got a BlackBerry, it meant I could stop putting my laptop around to stay in touch with work because I'm a one-woman office. So I felt like I needed to be in touch. But I like to think that I, you may not think so, but I think that I'm pretty good about setting some boundaries. But I can tell you that for myself, the technology does help me. When I was still in graduate school, I had to go to the library to look up the Toronto article. I like being able to access it online. I like being access to information because of the type of work I do. I need to have that, and it makes my job a lot easier. So I can say that there are certain things about it. The bad thing is, you know, do people expect me to email me back within a few hours if they're sending it? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. So I think that it can be a blessing and a curse. And you know, the question is, you know, can you teach that if your children are using that stuff? You know, my children like to watch TV. I don't like to watch TV. I seldom do. So, you know, how can we show our families and the people around us that you can use the technology for good and still have other important things in your life?
I was thinking about some of this last night, and I actually made some notes, and this is one of the things that I found myself thinking about. Because now we have so much information that comes at us from so many different directions, mm-hmm. almost at the same time, there's more demand for more information faster. So the latest digital devices are flying off the shelves as fast as they can put them out there. But these, all this instant communication, all this instant information, I think it can distance us from one another. You know, there may be some people in this room who don't have computers. And if you are one of those people, you may feel very distant from the vast universe of people who do, like your grandchildren. You know, people have learned how to use them so they can stay in touch with grandkids because they couldn't do it any other way. They can't get the grandkids to come see them, or the grandkids too busy to be visited, or whatever. So I think that these devices definitely not only create a digital divide, but they also send us wildly contradictory messages about what is the value.
Hi, I'm Judith Aronson, I live in Tenafly. In response to what you just said, to some degree, you know, everything is really a trade-off. And when you talk about technology and communication, one very big blessing that we've had has been in medicine and what it has done in terms of preventing disease and doing different kinds of technical operations with robots and things like that. I think that's been great. I think the other side of it is that we just get so many messages. I mean, even ID theft, you know, I mean, there's no way to control it. We're out in it covers the world. And the world has a lot of people in it. So everything is a trade-off. And everything's a trade-off with our children as well. And when you talk about parenting, I think it starts with marriage. You can't parent if you don't have a good marriage. And today that's like, here's the me generation. There's not the same unity that I see when my parents were married, when it was, we stick it out. It is better, for better or worse, and we do go on and help our children and talk and do things. It's just so different today, and it's difficult. It's very complicated.
Spiritual children, spirituality, religion, I mean, at least two of you felt that there was some connection to that, and yet you look around the world, and most of the serious killing going on right now has to do with religions dueling over each other's vision of spirituality, and it's, I don't know, it's a dilemma.
That hasn't changed.
No, that hasn't changed, and so each religion feels that they're spiritual, they have the spiritual answer, and they are very intent on killing others who don't have their same spiritual answer.
care about the war, who rather just go on with their own lives. Everybody loses, but the idea and behavior keeps coming back, you know, generation after generation, century after century. You know, I don't understand why we cannot just finally say, war is, you know, war is the pits, it's wrong, and we're not going to do it anymore. We're going to do something else. We're going to find some other way to resolve our differences and stick with that until we can make it work.
But because, I mean, each culture feels that they're raising their people in a spiritual way. Our spiritual way is to kill those people who have a different spiritual way. And it's, you know, I'm not disagreeing that we need to raise our kids in a spiritual way, but it just, you know,
Well, the last two questions allow me to address them together. I think war and divorce are kind of similar. And everything in life has three categories. There's the good, the bad, and the necessary. War and divorce are never good. They are almost always bad. And they are sometimes necessary. To say that we should keep a husband and wife together in a loveless marriage, where either may feel or both may feel disrespected, lonely, marriage isn't a prison sentence. And divorce has become very prevalent in our time, and probably a lot of it could have been saved. I actually think that we should make marital counseling tax deductible in the United States, so that couples who are having a lot of trouble will have a financial incentive to go and get help, because counseling costs about $150 an hour, and couples can't afford it. And yet studies show that 80% of the time, if you go to counseling, the marriage survives. By the way, if you're a woman, you're going to have to take your husband kicking and screaming to any kind of counseling. The husbands never want to go. So you got to get like a club and bop him over the head, drag him by his hair, the way the cavemen used to do to you a long time ago. But war is the same thing. I mean, Charles and I discussed this actually at the Veterans Day Memorial where we both spoke. He spoke about the evils of war, and he's right 90% of the time. But I can't make a blanket statement like that, because there's been many wars that have solved grievous injustices. And I gave some examples that day. Had there not been a civil war, and now we're commemorating the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War, slavery in America would have gone on for, I don't know, who could know, but 30, 40 years, 50 years? Maybe into the 1920s. It probably would have ended by then. But how many people would have died? And yes, 500,000 Americans died in the Civil War. These are astronomical numbers. But Lincoln saw no alternative to keeping the Union together and ending the abomination of slavery without federal troops fighting the Confederate troops. You know, I love the South, and I love visiting the South. But when I see the South now, even now, 150 years later, trying to say that it wasn't really about slavery, if you're watching all the things in the news over the past 2 weeks, it was about states' rights and all this other stuff. The major issue was slavery. And that war ended it. And it was the greatest American evil. So that was a war that I feel was just. The Second World War, where Jews were being gassed at a rate of 15,000 a day. That's not even the reason the war was fought. The Holocaust remained murky until 1943. The West didn't really even know about it. Even then, it didn't do much about it. But it was certainly fought to stop Hitler from taking over the world. And he was a very evil man. So that was a very just war. Then there are wars which are much more murky, or that we almost agree are not just. But I look at like a war like the one we're fighting today in Afghanistan. On the one hand, I say to myself, what the heck are American boys doing dying in Afghanistan? People have died in Afghanistan for thousands of years. Is anything good going to come of this? On the other hand, when I see the way women are treated by the Taliban, when I see the way their ears and noses are cut off, like on that Time magazine cover story a few months ago, because she didn't obey her husband when he told her to never speak disrespectfully to his parents, even though the parents were being abusive to her. And he pinned her down with the parents watching. And they cut off her ears and her nose. I say to myself, well, the richest country in the world may indeed have a responsibility to stop that. And it's terrible that it has to come through war. Terrible. I mean, the difference between me and Charles, to be honest, is just a difference of timing. The ancient Hebrew prophets spoke about a time when war would be abolished and the Messiah would come. That's where Dr. King excelled, by the way. Dr. King was able to give humanity, based on the Hebrew prophets, this perfect vision of a world that we could create that was purged of injustice and where all people were loved as equals. But we're not there yet, so I live in a different time zone. We're going to the place that Charles wants us to go, where war will be seen as stupid and immoral and abominable. But right now, when there's so many wicked people just killing innocent people, I'll give you one example of where there wasn't a war. The biggest genocide, the fastest genocide in world history was in Rwanda. It took place between April 1994 and June 1994. 333 people on average died every hour. It was a low-tech massacre. They were all macheted to death. And there's no question in my mind, and I'm not saying this because I'm in a mostly African-American church, there's no question in my mind because it was blacks dying in Africa that the world really didn't give much of a damn. And Bill Clinton was president. And we had just had the horror of losing 23 American soldiers in Black Hawk Down. So when he was asked, and when Madeleine Albright especially was asked, to simply use one American airstrike against the radio antenna that was broadcasting the genocide, the United States refused. It was a missile that would have cost us $50,000. Now, would it have ended all the killing? No, but it would have ended most of the killing because the killing was being coordinated by radio. One missile, 800,000 people died. Poor Africans who no one cared much about because it was black-on-black violence. I believe that America had a responsibility to send in troops, as did the UN, to stop that massacre. And there was a UN commander named Romeo Dallaire who wanted to stop the massacre. And he had about 500 troops or so at his disposal. And it was Kofi Annan who didn't allow him to, because not everybody believed that war is justified and we're only there as peacekeepers. But this was a genocide that was so preventable. And when President Clinton went to Rwanda and stopped for 4 hours, and they didn't even turn off the engines of his plane, he apologized. He said, we could have done more. Okay, I'm not here to criticize President Clinton. Presidents are good and bad. But the funny thing is, when Toni Morrison called him the first African-American president, I mean, not realizing that President Obama would be elected shortly, and he was a president who sat in office while there was a genocide in Africa, the two just don't compute. So Charles, I agree with you. War is terrible, and divorce is terrible. There are times when you have to fight. There are times when you just have to fight. Because there's bad people in this world, and we wish there weren't.
And there are times when people have to divorce because marriage is real bad. And, you know, having gone through that myself, you know, I know that sometimes it's necessary. I just feel, you know, with all my heart that we've got to constantly be looking for better ways to solve our differences rather than saying, you're wrong, so I must kill you. You know.
True. By the way, Charles, you are the first person to have ever read that book.
Well, I'm not done. I've read most of your book.
Well, you're the first person to ever have opened it.
I remember you said a statement earlier that typically religious institutions only harp on one or two issues, usually the gay marriage issue and abortion issues, and I think I agree with that statement. There's so many other issues that we need to be attacking. Tonight we're talking about family and raising children. And I'd like to hear actually some opinions on the actual marriage issue, because that does relate to raising spiritual children from your perspective, from your religious background. And so do you feel like it is possible and even theologically permissible to raise healthy spiritual children in the gay marriage situation, in a broken marriage situation, an abusive situation? Let's talk about that marriage issue. I'd like to hear, at least from you guys' perspective, on the marriage issue. And I know that there are other issues, but I think it's very relevant, particularly to this issue that we're discussing tonight.
Well, that's such an easy question. I'm going to let Charles handle it first.
I'm Charles as well.
you're what?
I'm the youth pastor at Bethany.
And his name is also Charles.
Oh, you're the youth pastor here?
At Bethany, on the other.
Oh, right, the other church, right, wow. What's your last name?
Taylor.
Nice to meet you. Are you married?
No, I'm not married. I'm 26, not married yet.
Are you eligible?
I am eligible.
Are you interested?
Well, I'm married already, but...
I used to work for an adoption agency, and because I worked for the adoption agency, my former wife and I became the parents of our first child. Our son, our other child, my daughter, is also adopted. What I learned and what I observed during that time period was that loving homes are almost always better than no homes. So. Placing children of one race with parents of another race. How could that possibly work? Right. And I was very skeptical about that. But I have seen and observed and borne witness that loving homes are able to handle a lot of that kind of difference. And I think if a loving home has two parents who are of the same gender in it, and they're doing everything they can to take care of their child or raise their child, you know, then the child has a good chance at having a normal, happy, successful life, whatever normal means, but a flourishing, developing to their potential. I think the ingredient that is very important is commitment of the people who are raising the child to each other first and then to the child. And if that's not present, it doesn't matter much what kind of relationship or what kind of marriage it is or isn't. Work. You have to have people who are committed to each other, to being a family, and to raising this life that's been given to them to care for.
May I interject really quickly? I was a theology major in college. I studied a little Talmud and Hebrew, and I'd like to kind of hit a little bit on the theological level. Is it theologically permissible for your faith background for that to work? So that's that. I'm sorry, I know it's a little specific, but I'm kind of, that's what I'm a little bit.
First of all, I wholly endorse what Charles said, honestly, and I wrote a column saying that very recently, that I'm amazed that religious people especially would oppose gay adoption when they are not prepared to adopt those children themselves and they'd rather leave them in an orphanage. The idea that I could be in a relationship with God through any particular faith and have a heart so shriveled that I would want to see a child left in an orphanage rather than have a gay man or gay woman raise that child astonishes me. And it just shows that religion can ultimately compromise our hearts and lead us to the wrong moral conclusions. I am well aware of what the Bible says about homosexuality. It's a subject that I've delved into very deeply. Not the homosexuality, but the verses. I remain a heterosexual male. I'm only saying that because my wife is here and she's looking at me like... My wife is just looking at me like, you did what? And I have a gay brother who's an Orthodox Jew. So the Bible has, my standard response, and it's not standard, it's come from many years of thinking about this, writing about this. I just published a column in the Wall Street Journal about it about a month ago, where I said, number one, yes, the Bible calls homosexuality an abomination, but the word abomination appears 122 times in the Bible. Proverbs says that gossip is an abomination, that a proud heart is an abomination, that lying, speaking deceitfully, is an abomination. So why do we choose this abomination as the greatest of all sins to make it the only moral issue we're talking about in America and demonizing gay men and women? Number two... theologically, in our religion, there's 613 commandments. 613 commandments in the Torah. And when I meet gay men and women who come to me in large number for counseling, I always say to them, look, the prohibition on gay sex is one commandment. The positive commandment to marry and have children is another commandment. You have 611 left. That should keep you pretty darn busy. I don't see why these two have to be the be-all and end-all. I'll give you an example. Every week at my house, we have a large group of Jewish people who drive to my house to have a Sabbath meal. Desecrating the Sabbath is a far greater prohibition in the Bible than homosexuality. It's repeated endlessly, constantly. And when you drive, and you can't light fire on the Sabbath, and driving a combustion engine, like driving a car or lighting a cigarette, that's a pretty serious... But do we treat people who don't observe the Sabbath the way we treat gay men and women? Somewhere along the line, we have to admit that homophobia crept into religion, and we decided that this is the only thing that matters. Would we tell a man and a woman who are not married, but who love each other and have been together for 20 years, that they should adopt and leave a child? You know, and maybe some would, but they would have far less objection to that than they would against gay parents. Even though you're not supposed to live together in sin. So, on my show, Shalom in the Home, we, for the first time in American television history, we had we highlighted a lesbian couple who have two biological children, two daughters, and one of the daughters was having problems. And if you know my show, if you're one of the 2.7 billion people who watch it every week, it's actually mandatory to watch it in China. It's a law. You'll know that we did that show like any other show. And so I go in and I try to help families that are in crisis. At the end of the show, and I said to the producers, we're not even going to mention that this is a gay couple. We're going to ignore the obvious. And I treated them like any other family. And as the show ends, so I go into this trailer and I always drive off. That's how it always ends. So this time I'm walking to the thing. They usually just film me going into the trailer and driving off. I'm walking to the trailer. I suddenly stop and I turn around. I look right at the camera and I say, you may have noticed that this is a non-traditional family that we've worked with. You may have noticed that there's no mother and father. There's two mothers. So why didn't I even mention it once this entire time? To teach each and every one of you that every child is of infinite value. And it doesn't make a difference how that child came into the world. Once they are here, they are our child to take care of. And the idea that this family should not be helped because they're gay, that idea is an abomination. And when I got into the car and I drove off, I remember doing a radio show with these two gay men who were Roman Catholic. And they had they paid a surrogate mother, and she had triplets. Now, if you remember the story, it was a well-known story like 5-6 years ago in the media. And they wanted the child to be baptized. And a Roman Catholic priest in their area said that the children couldn't be baptized because, you know, how they came into the world. I was amazed. I was on the radio, and I said, I think it's beautiful that you guys want to bring them up in a church. And you want them to have a godly upbringing. God bless you. We don't have to, you know, morality is not, it's not an all or nothing thing. It's just not. And to make it so black and white, it just denies the human condition. So it confuses me. In fact, you know, I hope that this conversation that we're having this evening, which Charles and this church has been kind enough to host, I hope that it'll be the first of many conversations. I have always had, I say this with complete sincerity, and you can't fake sincerity, there's a famous Jewish expression from the Talmud, the words that emanate from the heart penetrate the heart. I've always had a deep and abiding love for the African-American community. I've always had a very warm relationship with the African-American community. I feel that so many of the issues that animate the African-American community also animate the Jewish community. We have, and it's not just the shared history of oppression, etc., which it's the shared history of faith and hope. And there's so many similarities between our two communities. And each community has a failing that where it can learn from the other. I say as a rabbi, and I love my community, that the Jewish community is becoming too materialistic. We came, we were slaughtered by Hitler, we came to this country as immigrants, and we thought that financial security would mean life security. So we put ourselves into professions where we would earn a lot of money, and now it's not true. Money doesn't bring you security. Families bring you security, faith brings you security, friendship brings you security. I know tons of people who are super rich and they're on their third marriage and, you know, who cares? And their kids don't talk to them except to call them when they need money. They have no security. In the African American community, one of the failings is that homosexuality is an issue that's not talked about enough and addressed enough, and that people have to sort of hide it. Now that happens in the Orthodox community as well, the Orthodox Jewish community, less so in the less observant segments of the Jewish community. I was the first white radio host in WWRL, you know, 1600 AM, one of the most storied black stations in the country. And me and Peter Noel, my co-host, we used to talk about this all the time. You know, to his credit, Reverend Al Sharpton got up and said, in our community, we have to stop stigmatizing homosexuality. I'm an Orthodox Jew, so I'm not going to change the Bible's prohibition. I'm simply going to put it into context. I'm going to put it into a wider context. But I think our communities have a great deal to learn from each other. But when it comes to kids, I mean, whoever raises a kid, especially, I mean, Charles, you're a hero. You are a hero. I'm raising 9 kids, thank God, but they're my kids. It's my responsibility. The idea of taking a child who has no parents and raising that child as your own, I can't imagine that there's a more noble thing to do in this world than to take a child who's unwanted and unloved and to raise that child as your own. I can't imagine that God will shine His grace in any more forceful way than in that kind of activity, whether it's done by a gay man or a straight man.
May I respond to this one thing that you talked about? Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for what you just said. That's very, very affirming. I'm very moved by it. The alternative to adoption and having a loving home is not the orphanage anymore. It's foster care. And in its own way, that can be equally difficult because the bonds that naturally develop between parents and children because it's a foster situation, sometimes they don't develop, sometimes they develop, and then they have to be broken because it's a foster child, not your own child, not eligible for adoption by a foster family. It's its own kind of really difficult situation. In some ways, an orphanage might even be more stable, you know, because you're in one place, in one situation. Foster care is moving around a lot of times, and it's situated into and out of situations which are sometimes very damaging, sometimes wonderful. I don't demonize foster parents, but it is not a perfect system, and there's an awful lot of pain built right into it. That's why my former wife and I never became foster parents, because we knew once the child came in, we're going to get away.
I would like to comment about this woman's comment about divorce and this gentleman's comment about gay marriages. And I personally feel that a child strives and does well in any situation when they have a loving parent. It doesn't matter if it's one parent, two parents, or four parents. It doesn't matter if they are two women, two men, heterosexual. It doesn't matter if they are any color, any religion, how religious. If a child comes home to a loving parent who gives them time and attention and support and teaches them and answers their questions, they're going to thrive. It doesn't really matter. And I personally was in a very unhappy marriage. I never even thought about divorce because I didn't know anyone divorced. My parents weren't divorced. None of my aunts and uncle weren't divorced. None of my their friends were divorced. I didn't know anyone divorced. And I stayed married to a man I shouldn't have stayed married to. And I have 4 daughters. And I got the courage to say, I have to teach my children that you don't live with someone who is not good to you, who is not worthy of that situation, and you can rise and take the strength and move. So I took my 4 daughters out of that with myself, and even though I can't believe I'm a divorced woman, I feel I really gave my children something, the gift of, it doesn't matter if you're in a husband and wife and children, you have to protect yourself and you have to do what's best for you. And it doesn't matter what grouping you are. Just love them, teach them, give them time, and give them yourself, and they're going to be okay.
Where are you from?
I live in New Jersey, in Woodcliff Lake.
How'd you find out about tonight?
My girlfriend, Donna. First of all, I always read your articles. Somehow, she turned me on to you, and I get the Jewish Weekly Standard, and the first thing I do is I look for you. And everything that you've ever written, I've liked and agreed with, to be honest with you.
And we're perpetuating your mission.
We will tell you that we ourselves have decided that we don't like the way the girls of 13 to 18 year olds are growing up. So we've noticed it. I have 4 daughters, and I decided to get involved with my girlfriend. We started a mission where we're getting together with our friends' mothers to discuss the way the girls dress, the way they identify themselves. 15, 16, 17-year-old girls should not be drinking. Things that are going on, and people address children with special needs. We're going for the mainstream girl who is not identifying herself properly. She's looking at the people on television and the celebrities, and they want to look like them, they want to dress like them, they want to behave like them. And we're trying to stop it through the parents.
Through discussion.
But I want to tell you something that my father said to me when I was going to college, and I'm the oldest, and I was like the first woman in our family to go to college. And want you to ever feel that you have to make a living on your back. And he did not mean sleeping my way up. He meant that he wanted me to have the skills and the strength within that I should never stay in a bad marriage or a bad relationship, that I should feel dependent on somebody else for my happiness in this world. And so I know what it's like to have done that, to you know, figured out that I'm in graduate school, I have two kids, I have to figure out some way to get out of where I am because something has to be better, because I can't be a good, loving mother to my parent, to my children, and parent them the way I want to parent them when I am so unhappy and I'm not getting anything back except the love for my children, and that's not where it should be coming from. So I
believe the best way to parent is by example.
Right.
And they copy what you do. You have to walk the walk, just don't talk it. So that's the way I raise my girls.
First of all, when you speak about discipline, and it's not something we addressed tonight, I was amazed that on Oprah about 6 weeks ago, Katherine Jackson was being interviewed, and she was asked about her son Michael's allegations that he was hit, and she said, "Oh, black people hit their children." I was amazed at hearing that. I was amazed that there wasn't like a uproar in that kind of statement. And I know Katherine Jackson, and she's a very fine woman, but I've heard that from other sources as well, that it's almost accepted that this perception that in the black community children are hit. First of all, I hit my kids' hands occasionally. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world, but not beyond that. But this perception that discipline is... See, the reason why I object to those statements, when they're misunderstood, it makes it sound like discipline is a bad thing. Discipline's not a bad thing. I don't mean hitting a child. I mean putting a child in the corner. I mean telling a child that there's right and wrong. And not being afraid to show a child there's consequences to poor behavior. When you just make a blanket statement that this group hits their children, it makes it sound like it's not out of anger or something. And it smears an entire community. Anyone see that interview? I was amazed at that. I was amazed that Oprah didn't say anything. You know, Oprah's an amazing person. She didn't jump on that comment. When kids are not raised with proper discipline, when parents don't teach them right from wrong, they can really go off the right path. That's why the book of Proverbs is so clear. You know, someone, you know, Chosech Shifto Sonei Bano is the Hebrew. Whoever withholds the rod hates their child. That's a figurative expression. Again, it doesn't mean that you hate the child. There has to be consequences. That manifests itself today primarily by kids being out of the house at ungodly times. They do whatever the heck they want. They object to their parents' supervision. I'm opposed to any of this stuff. My daughters are not allowed to date boys recreationally. That's just the way it is. And when they object to it, I say, I'm sorry, there's no objection. In our community and in this home, we don't date recreationally. I'm not here for my daughters to believe that love is some sort of game or that it's some sort of flirtation. For me, love is the most serious, because I counsel married couples and I know how things go wrong and the earliest seeds of how. And my kids have to sort of rely on my wisdom and judgment. So I'm not surprised when you say that kids are out at all hours of, and it's not just in the black community here in Englewood. I've written a series of columns recently that the Jewish community has strongly objected to about what happens to Jewish kids who go to Israel for the year. It's a very common path in our community for kids to graduate high school and they go to the Holy Land for a year. And they don't have supervision. And a lot of them end up drinking. And when I wrote this, there was an uproar in the community. How could you criticize this incredible program of kids going to Israel? I said, the purpose of our kids going there is not to do whatever the heck they want. There has to be adult supervision. And I told my kids, two of whom are in Israel right now, that if you abuse the privilege, I'm going to come home and I'm going to take you home. Against your will, I will bring you home. But don't think this is just a year to do whatever the heck you want. It's a year to study. As far as what's happening here in Englewood and how haves and have-nots, look, let's face it. Englewood is a segregated city between white and black. It's astonishing. And we're all guilty. We're all responsible. There's almost no one that tries to bridge that gap of bringing the two communities together. You know, I just wrote a column last week about how I have been close to the African-American community all over the United States for 11 years, in every place but my own city. Maybe it's because you see your own city as a place where you just want to, like, be left alone. But whatever the reason is, there's very little understanding. And by the way, not all haves in the city are white. Not all have-nots are black. I'm speaking more about just a color divide. And what makes it particularly tragic, I think, is that they're both very religious communities. You know, there's so many synagogues in Englewood and there's so many churches in Englewood.
Not even teenage.
Yeah. Right. Oh, you live in teenage. I'm sorry to hear that. No, I'm kidding. All my Jewish friends say I should be living in Teaneck. Right, where it's all synagogues and kosher restaurants. I don't know how to solve it just yet. I know that tonight has been a beginning. And it doesn't matter how small a group we had. It's a phenomenal beginning. I want to tell you all that Reverend Charles Gilmore is a man of phenomenal grace. It was a pleasure meeting him, both at the Veterans Day Memorial and then later at Starbucks. And he immediately agreed to this evening, and very gracious man. I did not know that he studied at Princeton Theological Seminary until John said it tonight, but I'm not surprised. He's a man of, you know, phenomenal intelligence and insight. John Taylor, who's been my friend for 10 years, is a man of deep spirituality. He used to work for a church organization. He had me speak in the Martin Luther King Chapel at Morehouse College in the presence of Coretta Scott King, one of the great honors of my life. And I spoke there on a Saturday, and I couldn't use a microphone. And I told all the students to come forward, and they did. It was one of those, truly, even as I tell you the story, I could still see it so clearly. There was a deep-seated spirituality in the black community that I truly revere and cherish. I've always felt it. You know, if you're a rabbi and you lecture in front of, you know, your fellow Jews, so, you know, they'll look at you and they'll say, oh, it's nice what you said. That is, if you haven't put them into a deep coma within the first 10 minutes. But if you're a rabbi and you preach at a black church, the experience is just completely different. It's just amazing. Yes, preacher. You know, it's responsive. And like I said, we have a lot to learn from each other, not just in terms of socioeconomic status, not just in terms of what the communities can do for each other in terms of raising better children, just in terms of that shared spirituality. The black and Jewish communities once were very, very close during the civil rights movement. Then they began to drift apart. And then it got really bad with, like, a lot of public animosity. I've always tried to understand why. I don't know if I have the reason. I think many in the African American community started seeing the Jewish community as white, meaning they became uppity and socially and upwardly mobile, and they forgot their roots and materialistic and into money. The Jews began to feel, wait, that's not a fair accusation. That you're using old stereotypes against us. There was tremendous misunderstanding in the two communities. I think that, you know, some of the criticisms probably have merit, some don't. But I think we're past that. And now is a time, and I'm not interested in social dialogue between two groups of people because they have different skin color. For me, skin color means absolutely nothing, zero. Nothing. I used to say on WWRL all the time that if my child were to marry a black man, one of my daughters, who's Jewish, it would be like marrying any other Jewish guy. And I, not only could I not care less, I might even welcome it because I've always had this warm relationship with the black community. And there are so many black Jews in the world, who cares? But if my daughter were to marry a super wealthy, super successful WASP guy who's not Jewish, that would break my heart because my Jewish tradition is very important to me. It's my faith which defines me. It's not the color of my skin. The color of my skin is immaterial. It's two faith communities that I would like to see coming together. There is no community in America that is as faith-based as the African-American community. You go to Harlem and you see every block is another church. Faith has sustained this community. And I know now that it's being defined by other things, whether it's music or that's all fine, but the African-American community dare not lose touch with its roots in faith. The civil rights movement was a religious movement. Yes. Martin Luther King never had any title other than Reverend. It was a movement that started in churches. It was marched to Negro spirituals, always these spiritual songs that came from the Bible. And I think that our community, the Jewish community, has a lot to learn from the African-American community in that regard, because I feel that we are being detached from our roots. As I said before, Jews came to this country and they thought that money and status would guarantee our longevity because we were so persecuted. And it's not true, because our community, we've lost 1 million Jews in the United States due to assimilation, giving up our tradition, giving up our heritage. And since these are two communities that have always relied on their faith, I think that they have great commonalities, and I'd like to see, you know, so much more interactions between them. And like I said, you know, Charles, I hope that we can do a lot of events, whether it's talking about spiritual children or spiritual adults. But, you know, I lament the fact that we haven't done this until now, to be perfectly honest, and I'm almost ashamed that I personally, I don't want to go through my whole history, but I'm amazed that I have, you know, that we haven't done more. But I guess there's always a chance, you know, you got to start somewhere. Yeah.
Okay, we've gone well over what we thought we might. Is there a burning question? Okay.
Two things. Well, first of all, statement is, first of all, if the Orthodox Jewish community gave an upward to something you wrote, that means you wrote something good. That's number one. Number two, back to the issue of gay marriage, isn't it kind of comical that a country that everyone tells, you know, the government, don't tell me what I can smoke, don't tell me what I can drink, don't tell me what I can drug, you know, don't tell me how to drive, don't tell me, if I can gamble or not. Isn't it amazing that on one issue that affects maybe 1% of the country, they're suddenly all saying we've got to stand, the government has to stand up for morality and stuff like that? Isn't that like a joke?
In some ways, I would have to say, yeah, it is, because as Julie said, it's a hot button issue, and people focus on it, you know, just like abortion is a hot button issue. People can focus on that and sort of let the other huge problem, the other huge issues that are also plaguing us and bedeviling us, recede into the background. You know, let's focus on this. We can, you know, really get people riled about this. And I think we're going to get a great mistake, because we've got other issues going on. I quoted this statistic from one of my church members gave it to us last week in Bible study. I'm going to quote it again, even though I quoted it in the sermon yesterday, that in October of this year, 1 in 677 homes in New Jersey was foreclosed on. 1 in 677. That's a lot of houses, that's a lot of people, that's a lot of lives all messed up. And, you know, why aren't we jumping up and down about that? there are other issues.